Guy Alpervitz is had a distinguished career as a historian, a political economist, activist, writer, governmental official. He is currently the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, and is the author of a number of books, most currently America Beyond Capitalism. He joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. Professor Alpervitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Should I call you Professor Alpervitz, or what would you prefer?
You can go with anything.
Okay. I'll go with Gar, if that's all right.
That's fine.
First of all, as I say, thank you for joining us. America Beyond Capitalism was first published in 2005. This is a second edition with a new foreword, a new introduction. I guess my first question is, why a second edition, and is there a significance to it now?
Well, the reason for bringing it out now is we brought it out originally. It was at kind of the peak of we were doing well economically. And although the book predicted that there would be a increasing economic decay and social and economic pain and growing inequality, and also predicted, oddly, that there would be some sort of social explosion against this, at that moment in 2005, a book called America Beyond Capitalism was not something that people took seriously.
Mm.
With the growing crisis and the Occupy issues and so forth, the notion that there might be something, and which is the argument of the book, that there might be something beyond capitalism and beyond socialism, the traditional ideas, people are very interested in the question, so we thought it was time to bring it out.
One has to wonder whether there is any lasting effect from the Occupy movements. Certainly if there is, it may be the realization, the firm realization of something that perhaps a lot of people had suspected for a long time, and that is very few people control a very great deal of the wealth in this country. And therefore, I think your book does obviously addresses this in a very real way. And by the way, I enjoyed the book very much. The subtitle of the book is Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And you, in a number of occasions in the book, refer to meaningful democracy. Can you define what you mean by meaningful democracy?
Well, it's can be rather obvious and easy for folks to see it now. You see, in the midst of the Republican primaries, what counts again and again and again is money.
Mm-hmm.
Who can put the advertising up and who can put a powerful staff together and dominate the airwaves and dominate the door knockers and make sure that the things happen, and that costs money. Political science literature has known this for a long time, but I think you're right to say that the Occupy movement brought it to a head, but it would not have been possible for people to be so responsive had they not realized that was something really fundamentally wrong with democracy, in the sense that the dominant positions of money and power and corporate power, in particular large corporations with the lobbyists all over here. I live in Washington. They're just swarming.
Yeah.
People know that's not... That's not what we call democracy.
Certainly not what was envisioned a number of years ago. And I want to talk about all three, reclaiming our wealth, our liberty, and our democracy. And you have a number of ideas within each one, how we can move to a more meaningful democracy. But in each one... things are happening, perhaps not as fast as some might like, where people are gaining more voice. The concern, I guess, that I have, and you mentioned the money, is access. And how do we move from voice to access when in our system now it requires so much money?
Well, I wear two hats. One is a political economist, one is a historian. And the book, the argument of America Beyond Capitalism is that we're in a changing era, I mean, truly a systemic crisis. That is, there are large problems. Well, you don't move to access instantly in that kind of a crisis. The way to think about it is, in the decades, the 2 to 3 decades that preceded the New Deal, what was happening at the states and localities, building up slowly, quietly, agonizingly, very difficult, became the precedents that became the possibilities for the New Deal when the time came right. Or another way to think about the argument of America Beyond Capitalism, because it reports on all of these new experiments with worker-owned companies. There are 13 million people involved and 130 30 million people involved in co-ops and credits, all sorts of things bubbling up at the local level that the press doesn't really cover. There is a vast underground of changing the power structure slowly of the economy. And if you think about the way the women got the vote in the 19th century, it was state by state by state, slowly building up until enough power and ideas had accumulated so that then there was enough power to deal with national politics. That's the perspective of this book, and to argue for voice, you might look at one state or another where things are actually happening,
mm-hmm.
and then you see how it can happen in other states or cities as well. There are very interesting things going on in Cleveland, for instance.
You write that a society committed to enhancing equality, liberty, and democracy that is unable to achieve such values in practice, indeed that is moving in precisely the opposite direction, one would not have to argue too greatly that that is the case, is committed to a morally incoherent politics. What's a morally incoherent politics?
Well, I think that's the other piece of it, and we began speaking about it when we talked about democracy. We brought the book out not only because of the growing economic crisis and the growing inequality and the growing sense that money counts in democracy, but there is a moral crisis when people realize that our democracy is no longer what it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the intersection of the crisis in economics and social policy and changes that people feel in their day-to-day life with a simultaneous intersection of growing awareness that the system doesn't make sense morally anymore. It's not democratic.
Yeah.
And that those two things coming together tell you you're looking not just at one election or two elections, you're looking at the way in which the system is functioning as a system, and it's not living up to the values we all were taught. In fact, it's going just the opposite direction.
Just a few minutes ago mentioned the ideas that took hold and work that was done leading up to New Deal legislation. Is the crisis we're in now, obviously a whole different type of one, I guess you might argue, but is the crisis we're in now, or at least coming into, as serious as the Great Depression that prompted people to accept some of the changes that were being proposed?
I think it's more serious, but in a different way. The New Deal was a crisis collapse, suddenly, and into 25% unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, if you counted the way we now count people who were stopped looking for jobs and underemployment, it was probably 35%. And it happened at one big moment. I think we're now in a kind of rumbling, long, decaying process that is not likely to, we may go up and down a small amount, but I think the decaying feeling of long-term decay has its own characteristics. And I think one of them is people feeling that one of the things you can do is build over time slowly, because there's no other option in many communities. That's what we're seeing. The book, America Beyond Capitalism, reports on what's happening in many communities where the social and economic pain is growing,
mm-hmm.
and people are, of necessity, creating new alternatives, the most important characteristic of which is changing who owns wealth in a more democratic form. Systems are defined, you know, in significant part, obviously it's oversimplification, by who really owns the wealth, because so much political power comes from that.
Right.
And traditional capitalism, it was broken up into lots of little folks, small businesses, and that's really not America today. The dominant is big corporations and very, very, very wealthy investors who own large shares. State socialism or communism had the state owning the wealth. What I think is happening maybe at the bottom level, we certainly see a lot of development of democratizing the ownership of wealth in a way that could become the long-term preliminaries of the next vision. So, for instance, a co-op is one person, one vote, ownership of wealth. That's different from a giant corporation, and it's different from state socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 130 million Americans participating in either credit unions, which is a form of co-op,
sure.
or other kinds of co-ops. That's the kind of vision of a more democratic America at the grassroots level. And, you know, the book kind of traces what's happening in so many communities, not just co-ops, but
uh-huh.
worker-owned companies and so forth, and that projects some of the things that are happening in the states State Bank of North Dakota. Or if you go to Alaska today, you'll find that, unlike Texas, the oil revenue is split up so that everybody gets a share.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of law, that's a more democratic form. Some of the states, are 20 states, are looking at some sort of public form of single-payer health care. So there's a developmental process underway, the most important characteristic of which is changing wealth slowly in a more democratic way and institutionally, like a worker-owned company as an institution, or there are 2,000 public municipal utilities around the country, very conventional, but there it is. It's the community owns it. That kind of thing is what's at the basis of this vision.
And I want to remind our listeners, we're visiting with Professor Gar Alperovitz, who is professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. As you talk about that, I was struck in your book by the difference between, some people might argue, well, wait a minute, we've already got a system of wealth redistribution, that's taxes. You say that's not true, that if it were working, that would actually be income redistribution. And in fact, the idea that higher taxes hurt business, you also talk about, I think it was the late 40s, early 50s, when we had taxes way higher than we do now, and the economy was wonderful. You're really talking about wealth redistribution, aren't you? And there's a difference.
Well, both are important. They usually go together in some way. In the income, over the last 30 years, the top 1%, I mean, it's very interesting that the Occupy got onto this. There's a whole chapter in my book about the 1% versus the 98 or 99%. The top 1% over the last 30 years increased its share of income from 10% to roughly 24%. Now, it bobbled. It's gone down a little bit because of the recession, so it's just under 20 now. But just think about it. That's an enormous amount of money, and where did it come from in terms of shares? That meant the 99% had to lose rather than keeping up the usual pattern of the same distribution.
Right.
Where did it go? It went to the 1% at the top. That's income, and I think income taxation, whenever feasible, is certainly important. But where the real power comes from in politics is who owns the wealth, and that's even more concentrated. 400 people at the top. Someone did this calculation recently, and I had to double-check it several times. 400 individuals, it's really, you have to think about that, let that sink in, have more wealth than the bottom 50 or 60% of the society taken together. That's where the real power is.
Say that again?
The 400 people have more wealth than the bottom 60% of the society taken together. That's the Forbes 400, if you look at that grouping. It's extraordinarily concentrated. And investment wealth is equally, that is to say, factories and shops and who owns, as opposed to housing, your mortgage in your house, who owns that? It's very, very concentrated. Top 5% owns 70% of all productive wealth, stocks and bonds and factories and stores and farms and mines. So that's where the real power is.
Sure.
We see people like Mitt Romney and the Republican Party, the amounts of money that are made and held by such groups, and we can talk about him because his numbers are out in the public,
mm-hmm.
is really concentrated. And it's not surprisingly that, as everyone knows and as he has admitted, that most of his campaign finance comes from Wall Street folks, mm-hmm. his friends and the Bain Capital, and that's that group. That's where the power is. And it begins to subvert what we call a genuine democracy.
Yeah, one of the things that you address or feel that could address the problems is something that you called regional restructuring. And if I'm paraphrasing it right, you're saying that America has grown too big, both in terms of numbers of people and just the largeness of the continent, to truly have effective democracy and particularly on an economic basis. So you advocate smaller regional, even statewide, local, but regional type economies. That's dangerously close to the decentralization that conservatives are preaching, isn't it?
Well, You know, this is funny because this book is a very progressive kind of people, you know, at least liberal, more depends who's talking about it.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it gets a lot of, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric. But I have genuine respect, and as I write about it in the introduction, I have genuine respect for what I call a serious and thoughtful conservative. That's very different from a lot of the political, really hacks at the Washington level who are just using politics and ideology to make political points. But there is a strain in genuine conservative thought that was right about communism in the sense that they knew that this would destroy liberty, and many people on the left weren't aware of some of the problems. So, and also they were right about issues of community, that it's very important to reconstruct building blocks of community, certain parts of the traditional intellectual and serious thoughtful conservatives. Yes, but the issue of decentralization is a very important common ground between various parts of the anti-corporate movements, including the Tea Party in a funny way. The book that the way to think about it, though, I think is as follows. Can you really have democracy and democratic participation if a country is gigantic, is continental in scale? People think, well, we're like Europe in some. You know, you can drop Germany into Montana.
Yeah.
We forget how big we are. And we're now 315 million, approximately. We're going to 500 million. At the high estimate of the Census Bureau is we might be over a billion by the end of the century. Can you really have democratic participation in a continent that big? Ultimately, probably you need to have some form of decentralization. Most states are too small to manage economic matters. The continent's too big. And just per force of choice, what is the intermediate scale unit is the region. And the question then becomes, how do we do that? Not whether. And it's a very difficult problem. But I think it's inevitable if you want a democratic system.
And another question I had about that, I guess, is if you look at history, at least is what some historians have ascribed as some of the problems that we've run into, was because of regionalism, you know, the West versus the rest of the world, the South versus the whatever. What you're saying, though, is that doesn't necessarily have to preclude that from happening. I mean, from the regionalization happening.
No, I think the perspective is that you can't, I mean, you have to start with step one. Can you really have democratic participation in a billion people in a continent? Answer, probably no.
No, I would think most people would agree. And that, I think that's already being proven.
Yep. And Washington's broken is another way to say some of that.
Clearly.
So, this book has both lots of practical reporting of all the experiments that you can do right now because somebody else is doing it right now, like these worker-owned companies and millions of people are involved. But the other thing is it asks people to face some of these really fundamental questions. Where do we want to go if we have a systemic crisis, if we're talking about long-term change? What do we think? What makes sense? Really questions of political theory or the constitutional theory, and if you agree, just as we've discussed, that a society very large, moving towards a billion, and a continent is too large for democratic participation, then it means decentralization, and the question becomes, how do we think that through intelligently, and how do we begin to have a vision of that, and then a politics of that, a long-term politics? So the book operates on two levels. What can you do tomorrow to change and democratize wealth ownership? Like the many cities and communities that are doing it in many, many ways that the press doesn't cover, because it changes who owns the power base of wealth in politics, but also begin at the same time to get very thoughtful about what do we know about what it takes to have democracy or ecological sustainability, what are the principles that we need to begin to really debate and inform a new politics.
One of the things that you talk about with the number one, the continental, the size, and also the way the system is set up now, is that it's very difficult for people to become active politically for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that many people today have to work more than one job. And you advocate, or at least potentially, for a shorter work week, perhaps as short as a 25-hour work week, enabling people, number one, to get involved locally in terms of local economies, but also politically. Is there something that would indicate that that automatically happens?
I don't think anything automatically happens, but I think people don't, you know, if you stand back from the current economy with all of its problems, it still is producing just under $200,000 for every single family of four. It's a very, very rich economy.
Mm-hmm.
If we produce, even with all the recessions and depressions we had in the 20th century, the Great Depression, you know, war, massive wars, very expensive, recessions throughout, big collapse, that process produced 6 or 7 times increase in productivity, so that by the end of this century, if we do even as well as the kind of lousy economic performance of the 20th century, that number will be up near $1 million for every family of four that the economy is capable of producing, if we can manage it. We'll cut that in half, $500 million, it's a 20-hour work week.
Mm-hmm.
Cut it in half again, it's a 20. Even today, every family of four, today, if you redistributed the productive capacity of the economy, what we're now producing, every family of four would have, at 20 hours, $100,000, just under $100,000. So we don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem on how to manage the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. So we're a very rich economy, even though it's being badly managed by both Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Our underlying resource base and underlying technology is extraordinary, and it's also badly distributed, as we talked about earlier. But the basis of a 25-hour work week is already here if people were to recognize the resource base, and certainly it's growing as time goes on.
If someone were listening to this and said, what he's saying makes sense, how do I get started? I mean, we're up here in a little small community up in northeastern Minnesota. Hopefully somebody's listening to this and getting fired up about it. As one person, how do you get started? What do you do?
Well, I'm from a small community in Wisconsin, Racine, Wisconsin. But
yes.
Probably a little bigger.
A little bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so that's you're in my home turf. Is Minnesota and Wisconsin are, except when it comes to the football game.
You're still a Badger fan,
I'm still a Badger fan. Okay. So we take the Gophers down whenever we can.
And quite way too frequently recently.
Yeah. So, but that's my home turf. I feel that's where I feel at home. What can one person do? The revolutions and social movements always begin when somebody decides to act. One person,
mm-hmm.
they always, or small groups. So what I suggest is, the Chinese chairman Mao, the Chinese communist chairman, said, you know, power grows out of the muzzle of a gun. And the American women's movement said, no. The way power grows is you get half a dozen of your friends together and you read something and then you decide, what can we do here to start right now? And you support each other and get going and roll up your sleeves and do something. And then other people follow and more other people follow. And that's where power, that's how the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, even the conservative movement, though that's the way it's done. So my suggestion is, you know, there's plenty going on around the country that can be done that you can learn from. The book, America Beyond Capitalism, reports on it and gives
Indeed.
You some websites where you can find out more that the press doesn't cover. Call, you know, if you're interested, call your half a dozen friends together for coffee or, you know, pizza. Sit down and say, we want to talk about what can we do here. Maybe read a book. I can recommend a wonderful one.
I can too. You bet.
And then find out what else people are doing in other parts of the country, and then say, hey, let's see what makes sense here as a starting point.
Let's try that too.
Yep.
Well, and I absolutely was going to say, if people will do that, I can absolutely lend them the book because I enjoyed it immensely. And I think it's an important book that people need to read. Our guest has been Professor Gar Alperovitz, who is professor of political economy, at the University of Maryland, a founder of the Democracy Collaborative, and is the author of the book we've been talking about, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Good. thank you, and let me know how those meetings go.
I will do. I'll do that indeed.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks.